Welcome to the latest episode of the Warships Pod. And my guest is David Larter. Hello, David. I'm wondering if you could introduce yourself to us.
Hi, Ian. Thank you so much for having me on today. I covered the U.S. Navy for a long time, about a decade, with First Navy Times and then Defense News. Prior to that, I was a sailor for 4 years, from 2002 to 2006. Graduated from the University of Richmond and had my journalism career, and then obviously moved on from that. And now I work still in the area, but more on the industry side today. So that is that's what I do.
Right. So, I mean, with a background like that, you're obviously very au fait with global naval issues and all the various nuances that happen around the world. And of course, you know, especially with the US Navy. But what about the naval side of the Ukraine war? Do you think there's much going on there that will have a long-term impact on how navies operate?
Well, you know, here's the I guess the 30,000 foot view, if not higher, maybe 50,000 feet. If you're up 50,000 feet, you can see the whole globe. and 60,000 feet, you can see at least a big chunk of it. And I think that's more the scope we're talking about, right? Because the ongoing blockade of the Ukrainian ports is going to have a global impact. And that, of course, kind of strikes at the heart of, well, why do navies exist? Well, I think primarily the reason that Western navies exist, UK, US, you know, various EU nations, held for a long time that, you know, that freedom should be free and open to commerce. Obviously, the Black Sea is a little different, governed by the Montreux Convention, but the basic premise that commerce should be free and open is kind of the heart of why navies exist. It's why we have all these ships, and it's why we spend an enormous amount of money to keep them manned, trained, and equipped. And so the present situation in Ukraine, obviously, is that there's a pretty formidable Russian blockade. Ukraine's had some success, you know, localized success. Obviously, they sunk the Russian flagship, and that was a big morale boost. But de facto, the blockade's still going on. It's not done. And the Western powers now have to figure out what they're going to do about that, right? I mean, there's Turkey has essentially a veto over any ships coming in and out. If you just look at a map, you can see that. And they've decided that this counts as a war. And under Montreux Convention, that certainly prevents Russia from exiting the Turkish Straits. No one's allowed to come in either, certainly not combatants that are participating in the war. And it's certainly debatable whether NATO or European countries that have all lined up against Russia count as combatants, but it's a thorny legal issue and one that's going to have to take direct diplomacy. But what are the stakes if you don't, right? Well, I think the United Nations has made very clear that it's going to drive up food prices everywhere in places that can least afford them. Africa is one area of particular concern. Southern Asia is an area of concern. But ultimately, I think this is ultimately going to end up being a Navy issue, or very well could be a Navy issue. So where does it go from here? Well, I think it's going to have to be, Turkey has engaged with Russia to try and open up exports. But Russia is clearly using this blockade as leverage. I think it's very clear that this blockade is a form of blackmail to the international community, which has leveraged pretty harsh sanctions on Russia. And at some point, this may come to a head to the point where Turkey is now on board, or you know, the global community is increasingly on board with some kind of an ultimatum. And I don't think what that means is we go in there and sink the Russian blockade. I think that what that could mean, and it would have to be pieced together very carefully, and using a lot of sort of navies that are from the Black Sea, primarily to do things like mine clearing and escort duty. But it's going to require some junction if this does not change. Either there's going to be a global famine, or there's going to be some sort of naval action, and that's intense. It's a very precarious situation.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I found it interesting that when Lavrov was talking about what could be done with the Turkish representative the other day, he was suggesting in that kind of slightly humorous, I always feel, and menacing fashion, that, of course, you know, it's down to the Ukrainians. And if they just clear out the mines and, you know, not try and sink things with missiles, that, of course, their grade ships could come out, which was just a sort of a roundabout way of saying, you know, let us invade you. I mean, that was the way that I saw that. And I don't think that's going to persuade the Ukrainians at all, is it?
Well, no, this is classic Russia, right? I mean, remember at the outset of the war, there was this big to-do, or just before the outset of the war, there was this big to-do of, oh, Russia's pulling back. They're pulling back troops. And they came out and said, oh, now we've truly refuted the war propaganda from the West. Because look, we're pulling troops up, but they hadn't. It was just a couple of tanks rolling on, I guess, freighters or something like that, or some armored vehicles that were leaving the area. But it was all staged, and so, you know, that Russia, they talk about on cyber networks these days, they talk about zero trust, and I think that's a good way to, you know, that nothing that's coming on that network should be automatically trusted. It should all be verified. There should all be sort of two-factor authentication. And I think that's absolutely the case with Russia, too. You don't take Russia at their word. They're almost certainly lying. Let's all let our guard down. And then all of a sudden, oh, well, you can solve world hunger. No, I agree. That's a slightly humorous but very menacing way of putting it. From Lavrov.
Yeah, and one of the things that happened yesterday, I think, was President Putin talking to some young Russian entrepreneurs and economists and also scientists, I think. And it actually reminded me a little bit, and this is, you know, I'm being slightly humorous here, a little bit of Lebowski's, what is it, Little Urban Achievers. And this was Vladimir Putin as the big Lebowski, not the big Lebowski, sorry, Mr. Lebowski, the original Lebowski, the one he got confused about, was in the wheelchair there. And in the film, because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the movie, The Big Lebowski, which I know you and I both like a lot.
We're both big fans.
Yeah. So there was Vladimir Lebowski, as it were, sitting in his chair and talking to these kids. I mean, I'll call them kids because I'm that old. But I mean, he was talking to the bright, and he called them, what was it, the good looking, the intelligent, and the smart. I mean, that's how he sort of buttered them up a little bit. But then he outlined this this whole vision of his, because the day before, or this would be a couple of days ago, he went to the Peter the Great drama thing that they've made with multimedia interactive stuff in St. Petersburg. And I think this was in Moscow, this meeting with the urban achievers, as it were. And President Putin's sitting there, and he's doing what he often has done in the past, which is to actually explain in very clear language what he's going to do and what he's all about. And so he was explaining about Peter the Great, and that, you know, the Swedes had a bit of Russia, and, you know, it was, who said it was that, in essence, he was saying, you know, they said it was their sovereignty, but actually Russian people had lived there as well. And so Peter the Great built St. Petersburg there, and then he decided he would push on with the Great Northern War for 21 years. And that was, you know, much of that, or some of that, was settled at the Battle of Narva. So I very quickly reminded myself of where Narva is. And of course, Narva is in Estonia. And Estonia voted after the First World War, and I think after the Civil War, that it would join the people of that area decided they would join the new Estonian Republic. And half of them were Russian and half of them were Estonian. So they said, you know, goodbye, Mother Russia. And then 20 years later, Russia got them back. So now it just seems to me, in setting out his stall as the new Peter the Great and mentioning those things like Narva, St. Petersburg being established on land that, you know, Russia seized, he was basically telling us that, he, you know, it's not over even after Ukraine, I suspect. I mean, do you think it will go further?
It's interesting that you point this out, right? So I talk about zero trust, and it is always dubious to take Vladimir Putin's word, but there are these moments where you do get the hints that of what this guy actually believes, right? And I think that you've identified one. Another one was this op-ed that he ran about, I guess, the point was that it was this ethnic unity of Ukrainian and Russian people, and essentially that they were the same people and that they always had been and always would be. And those are the kinds of things where I think he's actually being honest, because when he's talking about things like NATO expansion, or he's talking about missiles in Romania or in Poland, as that I think if that ever happens, if they ever get that online.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
When he's talking about those things, those are secondary concerns to this larger, somewhat unbalanced vision of this expansionist Russia. And there are those who'll tell you that, oh, well, Russia's just naturally expansionist. And yeah, I mean, I guess you could make that point. But then the counter argument and the pushback here is, right, like, oh, well, Ukraine is in Russian interest. Right. And the thing that I always try to remind people when we talk about these things is the rules-based international order is, for as much as Russia sees Ukraine as its national interest, the Europe, United Kingdom, United States, Canada, Australia, Japan, these sort of like-minded nations, this rules-based international order is core to their national interests. And if it's there is a sense by which if you let it erode and you don't stand up to these sort of expansionist delusions from lunatics like Putin, lunatic is maybe the wrong word, but the grand total is lunatic, right?
Yeah.
It's not like he's just bouncing off the walls going gaga every day, but the sum total of his ideas are unbalanced. But if you don't stand up to it, there are other powers that also want to benefit from this eroded international order. So you have to stand up to it. I don't think it stops there, but I think he's sustained enough damage to his army that at least in the short term, it's probably Ukraine is all he can manage, but that's, what is that? How long does that solve the problem for? I don't know, maybe a couple years, 2-3 years.
Yeah. Something that's in the next magazine, basically Odin has suggested, and we have done it before in the magazine, that actually the key battle, the key aim here will be to get Odessa and cut Ukraine off entirely from the sea, because that's then essentially that's Ukraine kind of game over in terms of being an independent, totally independent and prosperous state. So do you think that actually, like you said there, they'll stop, they may have a pause, they'll get the Donbass as much as they can, and then even if he decides that that's some kind of victory, they're merely preparing for the next bit, which is the key objective, which is Odessa. Do you think that that's going to be the deciding factor, and that the blockade thing is all bound up in that as well?
Oh, I think Odessa is clearly the key port, and it's the key cutting Ukraine off from the sea is, we're all navalists here, right?
Yeah.
And I think we understand the wealth and the commerce and the connection with the world that happens when you have a port and when you have commerce that comes in and out. It just really cannot be replicated by land. If you look at sort of big land-bound powers throughout history, there's this, they have this tendency to, they expand over land, but they also have this tendency towards authoritarianism, right? When you have that sort of, if you look through history, you see like the very naval powers and the sort of very outward looking ocean connected, those tend to be a little bit more open, democratic, or at the very least cosmopolitan societies. And I think that when you, if you cut Ukraine off and turn them into a land power without the income and without the sort of global importance to the world that it has, exporting grain, that is kind of the, you remember the American Civil War, the Anaconda Plan, you choke off the Confederacy, eventually they'll die. It's a slow way to win a war, but if you choke off Ukraine in the long term, the broad arc of history, and I think that's the way Putin looks at it. I mean, he's talking about Peter the Great. That does essentially fulfill the long-term strategic objective. If they control Odessa and they cut Ukraine off from the sea, they will eventually just meld back into Russia because they'll have few options.
Yeah. When you look at what's happened with Russia, one of the things that we as navalists would immediately spot, and it's interesting that he's now emphasized the Peter the Great element, is that he has, from the beginning, really, maybe it's when he got the shock in 2000 with the Kursk that his navy was basically knackered, as we would call it in the UK, and then he ordered it to be re-energized along with other elements of the armed forces. He has always seen, I think, the navy and access for his navy to help project power around the world and protect Russia as a key thing, which is why he obviously secured, they obviously secured, the Russians, the Crimea, Sevastopol, as their base, because it's the southern flank, and then there's the access to the sea, to the eastern Mediterranean, where he was determined with the Syria involvement to make sure that Tartus could be a major support facility. And in looking at the Ukraine, he's thinking, I wouldn't mind having all those, like Mykolaiv and all that, I wouldn't mind having all those industrial centres, you know, shipbuilding centres and ports back, and we'll have Odessa as well, which means quite a lot in Russian history. So it strikes me that maybe Western world leaders in general have maybe not really understood how a lot of it is driven by the Peter the Great thing of having access to the sea,
yes,
of having, you know, a window on the world and access to the sea. So I think maybe our leaders should have read a bit more of Robert Massey, Peter the Great, His Life and Times, a massive book to understand Vladimir Putin a few years ago, you know. So it's interesting.
What I'd say on that, so 2 points. I'll backtrack to my brilliant comments about sea states being that's credit to Andrew Lambert, right? Sea Power States is a great book if you want to kind of understand how the open societies tend to be seaborne societies, and land powers tend to be more authoritarian and more closed off, and more you will assimilate. I do think that Putin does have this fixation on warm water ports, and if you look through Russian history, that ain't nothing new either, right? So that's been a continuous struggle for them for the entirety of their from all of modern European history that I can recall, that I know about anyway. And I think this is where I think Turkey needs to pay attention, right? And I'm sure they are, and I know that I know that their sort of decision to a limited extent try and pivot back towards NATO comes from this sort of innate understanding, because how much history has been driven by Russia's desire to control the straits entering the Black Sea, right? Major national security objective for Russia for centuries. You know, it was a pivotal factor in even things around World War One, and ultimately that's why Turkey decided to join NATO in the first place, right? It was to protect that. And so if you're Turkey, you have some time. I don't think they are going to face a Russian invasion tomorrow, partly mostly because they're in NATO. But I think if there's a long game here, right, if you think about what could possibly be 20 years down the line, okay, well, let's say NATO just disintegrates. What if I fatally undermine NATO? Then where does it go? So if you think long term, Russia's goals seem pretty static, right? It's all Putin seems to think about, this sort of restoration of great Russia, and great Russia controls the Turkish Straits. If you look at the long arc, I think Turkey is going to be key, which is annoying because Erdogan is irascible and overplays his hand consistently. But I think there's some room here to push back on him and say, look, it's not your turn now, but it will be. This is the Putin plan. But if you look at Putin's strategy, it's all been about undermining NATO.
Yeah, yeah.
Even his interference with the U.S. elections, it created in our country this bizarre, and it's still a minority of the right, on the right that's pro-Russia, that's pro, because they see him as this like Christian nationalist, which of course he is not at all. Putin doesn't I don't think Putin has strong religious convictions. But at the same time, you know, the idea of let's sort of capture a portion of the American electorate that'll be behind us, and maybe we can fatally undermine NATO. And it very nearly happened, right? I mean, Trump was, by all reports, very close to just pulling out of NATO at several points. And at that point, NATO is fatally undermined. So, no, I don't think in Turkey as part of NATO has any threat from Vladimir Putin. But if NATO is no longer a factor on the board, then things change.
And the thing that maybe we overlook, and when I say we, I mean you're on the west coast of the USA and I'm in southern England. We overlook in the West, as it's become known again, because I think that term died out a bit, but it's back again, is that actually a large part of the world doesn't actually back perhaps NATO instinctively or the West. And if it doesn't have, you know, interests in common with Russia, like China, then it just doesn't see it as its affair. You know, it's a war in a faraway place, Ukraine, and they see it as more the great powers, the old great powers, Russia, you know, the Europeans with America in there as well, having a bit of a tussle and a disagreement over who should have Ukraine, a country which a lot of the world never have really thought about very much at all. So, you know, there is a large part of the world that isn't invested in it as much as we are in whether Ukraine wins or Russia wins. And they just want to see who comes out, and then they'll decide what they do, and they'll try and have relations with both sides, won't they?
I mean, it's a real shame that the rest of the world isn't tuned into this, if they aren't to the same degree. And there's a certain degree of complacency there. But at the same time, I mean, I think we've witnessed two world wars where the pain of the struggle for some kind of definition of the world order. And World War One is a little dicey because that didn't really become a major factor. It was kind of in the middle of it, right? I think it started as we don't want Germany to dominate all of Europe. And then it kind of became this larger struggle of, well, what does the world look like so this sort of thing doesn't happen again? And I think that the pain that struggle visited on places like Africa, China, is very real. And certainly that carried on into World War II in just absolutely cataclysmic fashion. And so these ideas about how does the world work? How do we solve our problems between nations? How do we define borders? Is it by ethnic group? Or is it by shared political consensus? I mean, that's not an argument that we can win or anywhere, but it is a struggle you constantly have to wage. And we've bowed out to a certain extent. Some people have this view that, oh, well, it's not my affair. And so it's prevalent in the United States. I don't think it's the majority. I think the majority still support a U.S. NATO Western worldview of how these things should work, but they've become less relevant. Our politicians are not necessarily talking as much as they should about it and the benefits of it. And it's a great shame, right? Because so much blood and so much treasure and so much sacrifice went into as much gains as we made, right? I think maybe one of the mistakes is we thought it was an end state, but it certainly was not.
Oh, you mean the end of the Cold War was just, we've settled.
Right. But that we just won. Like the whole rules-based order was, that was it. And like, oh, finally, we finally won.
Yeah.
But that's, it wasn't an end state. It's constantly a journey and it's constantly a fight to wage, which is why Russia can't win, right? We can't allow Russia to walk away from this thinking that this is a valid strategy. Yeah, it was harder than we thought. Yeah, they really gave us a bloody nose, but look, we now control all of Donbass, and in a few years we'll control Odessa. That's such an unacceptable outcome, and it may be the outcome, but again, I don't think that we can accept the outcome.
Yeah, you were talking there about World War One. One of the things that comes into my mind when people are talking about the blockade, or when the magazine is looking at the blockade, or you know, you see things on Twitter, is a reminder that in World War One, it was the Royal Navy's blockade of Germany that was described by somebody. It was either somebody on the British side or somebody on the German side called it War by Hunger. And I actually know it's an American. I think it was the American ambassador writing to Woodrow Wilson, said this is becoming a war by hunger, because by 1917, actually Britain, unlike World War II, where Britain never came close to starvation due to U-boats, in World War I, due to the failure at that point in 1917 to get to grips with how to convoy things and just deter the U-boats and outrun them, Britain was coming close to starvation, which didn't compare with Germany, where they were eating bald crow, you know, and they were like collapsing with mass starvation. Britain was edging towards it. So war by starvation, you know, the war of hunger or whatever you want to call it, that has been a feature of past wars and of World War One in particular. That's what I always think of when I see this stuff about Egypt and the Lebanon and I'm trying to think where else in North Africa, possibly starving due to the fact that they in particular rely on Ukrainian grain. So there are lessons in history there. They're not identical to today's problems, but that is a lesson in history, I feel.
Well, to me, it's like there's this, and this gets back to what role will the navies ultimately play in this? We're going to have to figure this out. We're going to have to figure out a way to make it safe for grain to leave. For grain to leave Ukraine. We're going to have to prevent Russia from using a now demined and a demined Odessa approaches to then launch an amphibious invasion. And we're going to have to, at some point, if we can't work out a deal, if Turkey can't work out a deal with Russia, that doesn't end up with us just rolling back all the sanctions or rolling back significant sanctions that allows Russia to get access to microelectronics again or to the global finance system to keep, you know, essentially pumping money into its war machine. Like, those are unacceptable outcomes too. So what's happened is that using this blockade, Putin has a gun to some of the poorest countries on Earth's head. These things do have global consequences. And right now, Putin has a gun to the heads of some of the poorest people on Earth. And by the way, it doesn't stop there, because markets are markets, right? The oil market is insane right now. I'm sure you're paying much more for gas than I am, and I'm paying through the nose for it. And this is a direct reflection of the impact of the war in Ukraine. So if people are actually starving in Africa or North Africa or the MENA region for want of grain from Ukraine, then that is going to drive up prices everywhere else too, right? So it's not just the people that just can't afford to buy it now that will now starve and die because they didn't have it. It's also everyone else. And so if we now see, and does the world, or does the United States and does Great Britain need any more instability in society due to rising prices and a slipping economy, right? Because I think right now, both societies could use a break from instability.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I agree. In the West, of course, when it comes to military action, the Europeans, who President Trump was critical of, but in fact, you know, previous presidents had also been critical of European nations not putting in enough money or enough effort into NATO, looked to the USA for leadership and also for key capabilities and key power and all the rest of it. So this, of course, you know, we're a naval magazine. Warship Sci-Fi is a naval mag, so I'm always thinking about the naval dimension. So for me, you know, the Colossus of today, 100 years on from World War One, when there was that war by hunger, you know, World War One, when it was the Royal Navy, the Colossus now is the US Navy. And, you know, as somebody who's well-versed in current naval operations and the stresses and strains of all that, how do you think the US Navy is able to cope adequately or well? Can it cope with another major mission? You know, can it, you know, handle the Gulf? Can it handle China? Can it handle looking at North Korea and various other places, along with this Black Sea thing? I mean, what state is the US Navy in? Can it actually handle such a thing, even if it could get into the Black Sea?
So I think any approach to that, I think is going to have to be, I think we would probably still want to remain compliant with the tonnage limitations imposed by the Montreal Convention, which means we can maybe get two DDGs in there. So any approach to this is going to have to, I think the U.S. would gladly lead it. I know the Royal Navy would gladly lead it. I think it's going to have to be, and we're going to have to back it, right? I think that's the thing. I think there are Black Sea nations who would love to help out if they knew that the military might of the Western alliances would be behind them. Because if it's just Romania there trying to clear mines and get grain out, Putin could very well could be the blockade is his policy. Everyone's aware that it's his policy, and then within the bounds of that policy, as barbaric as it is, that he would kind of be within his rights to take action. So yeah, and he would wipe the floor with those smaller navies. How many aircraft does he have?
Yeah.
within range to make that kind of a mission impossible. The only way it would work is if our jets and our to whatever extent is still allowable, our air defense was there to help. And our anti-submarine warfare capabilities were there to help. At that point, if that kind of a mission went down, which I would think would have to be led, would probably have to be led by a Black Sea nation, but then obviously with the implicit military backing of the NATO, not NATO, I would have to say it would probably end up being not a NATO mission, but sort of all the individual countries coming together, just in case Russia did decide to attack it. But that's all legalese and we could sort that out later. But I think, yeah, we would have to have our air defense there. We'd have to have our ASW there in some capacity. But I don't think, that could all be handled with just the ships we have in Rota, I imagine, and the aircraft that we have in theater already. But unless there's the implicit threat that if Russia interferes with this operation, that they'll get shot down or sunk, there's no way that this kind of a mission would be successful. So yeah, I think we can handle it. We can walk and chew gum. I don't think we have any interest in an all-out naval war, but that's not to say an all-out naval war wouldn't be interested in us.
Right. Yeah, of course.
So, yeah. So you'd have to balance it. If we were then getting into full-on wartime, we could balance that too. We do have an enormous force structure. It isn't as much as it needs to be to cover everything that we have and what we need to do. We do have a declining industrial base, which is a problem in the long term and in the short term.
This is the USA you're talking about specifically.
Yes.
Yeah.
Specifically.
Yeah.
But for right now, I think the demands that would be placed on the U.S. Navy and U.S. Air Force and naval aviation, I think we could handle it. If we had to do that kind of a blockade running mission. And that's all predicated on Russia wouldn't be stupid enough to stop us, but maybe they would be.
Right. So, I mean, the warships themselves and the people in the Royal Navy is now a third of the size it was at the end of the Cold War and has its own problems with force levels and a ability to deploy it. It's actually much better now than it was a few years ago when outside of certain areas like the Gulf and the home waters and I think the Mediterranean, the Royal Navy vanished for a few years but then came back. But it's still, the Royal Navy of today is small. It's not got, as we discussed on the last podcast here, it's not got offensive firepower. It's got to upgrade its defensive firepower as well. So it's got a lot of things to do. And so in the UK, we talk about, you know, there's this wrong with it and there's that wrong with it. But of course, the US Navy, we look at the US Navy, say we look at the US Navy and think, well, there's the giant of the seas, you know, that shoulders a massive burden around the world. But of course, the US Navy itself has problems within its own structure and within its own orbit that it needs to deal with, doesn't it? So it's just a matter of scale, I guess. The problems are bigger.
I mean, you're probably well aware of this, and obviously, you know, because you're tuned into the issues, but, you know, the U.S. Navy's had a number of headwinds that, yes, it is overcommitted. Yes, our combatant commanders, regional combatant commanders, and for those who don't know exactly what that is, we the U.S. military divides up the globe into combatant commands, led by four-star generals and admirals. And they request forces, and those forces are apportioned through this process called the Global Force Management Allocation Plan, GIFMAP. And then, you know, the service chiefs will say, we can't do that. And then the DOD will say, well, you're going to have to. And so the Navy's been getting a lot of, well, you're going to have to, for a long time. And they've, and they're overstretched, and there's too few ships. And the other problem that we're really walking into now is that there was a massive buildup in the 1980s. A lot of the new technology we introduced, Aegis, which is really world-class and has defined what modern navies look like today, these multi-mission surface combatants that dominate the surface fleet, you know, certainly the focus on carrier aviation. It's certainly not unique, but the U.S. Navy obviously has the most of it. That's all in a greatly diminished state from where it was at the end of the Cold War. There's fewer ships, and they're underway just about as much as they were at the same force levels. So whereas it was like an eighth of the fleet that's underway at any given time in the Cold War, I would have to verify that number. It's probably about right, hypothetically, say eighth of the fleet is out at any given time. Now it's a third to a quarter. And it only seems to get worse. And that's unsustainable, as anyone that understands how navies work. It's unsustainable because ships don't just go out indefinitely. They have to be repaired. They have to swap crews. They have to do any number of things that it's required to do in port. They go into the yards for a good amount of time. Then when they come out of the yards, all the skills need to be refreshed because you can't send sailors forward if they don't know what they're doing. You can, and we've done that and gotten bitten by it, but it's not advisable. And then once they go out and they do their mission, they deploy, they come back, they have to repeat the cycle. They go back in the yard. So we are deploying at unsustainable rates. All those ships we built in the 80s and 90s, they're all getting about to their hull life, which is depressing. The ship that I served on was about, I think, 10 years old when I was on it, and it's just about ready to decommission. It needs to decommission. But ultimately, we haven't been able to build as many ships as are coming out. So we're losing capacity, we're losing our ability to keep up. And then we went down some rabbit holes on acquisition, and I think those trials and travails are pretty well known, the carrier, the Littoral Combat Ship, and then the Ford class carrier. So it's not a great position. And there was actually a compelling article out this week by an Army general, which I was surprised to agree with. And he called for, in Breaking Defense, called for a sort of a blue ribbon panel, like a commission to examine in detail the issues with the Navy and figure out how to right the ship, because, and I think that's right. I think we do need to take a national look at this and figure out how best to employ the fleet, because we are going to lose our advantage. We cannot defeat the PLAN on our own. We can't hold down Europe and Asia on our own at the rate at which our fleet is declining.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting proposal. I mean, I've often thought that what Britain needs is something like that, but I think the a national effort to look at it and sort the Royal Navy out. But I think what that requires is an awareness within the political sphere and other people that actually it is important to sort it out. But I don't think in the UK there is that impetus for like a Royal Commission to sort out the Royal Navy. It isn't there. We have a Defence Committee which does a good job of pointing out and things that are wrong and then harassing the MOD about things that are not there, you know, like anti-shipping missiles and not enough submarines, etc. But, you know, it is good, yeah, to see an army general actually recommending that, because I can't imagine that ever happening in the UK. And certainly not an Air Force air marshal either. So there's a lot of rivalry here that would never allow that to happen, for somebody to show that much interest from a rival service. And the First Sea Lord and the other people are doing what they can, and they're doing a lot with not a huge navy and a navy that needs a lot of improvement. But I think the UK needs some kind of thing like that as well. So it's interesting that suggestion came up. But of course, in the USA, there's one thing that the US Navy can rely upon to bang the drum for the US Navy, and I believe raise recruitment by 500% or something, and that's Hollywood.
So yeah, we did okay, didn't we?
Yeah. Yeah. So obviously what I mean by saying that Hollywood has raised recruitment by allegedly or reportedly, I may not have that right, by interest in joining the US Navy, shall we say, by 500% was the debut of the movie Top Gun Maverick. And that is a legendary recruiting device, I think, for the American fleet. And so have you seen Top Gun?
Saw it. Really loved it. Really enjoyed it.
I've seen it too, and I thought it was good. Yeah.
Yeah. The things about Top Gun that I thought were great. First of all, I like that they didn't try to hide the fact that Tom Cruise was way too old to be a captain. I think actually the fact that he is a captain, that it exists at the largesse of a senior admiral who did much better than him, is a believable story arc. It's not so far-fetched. That somebody would just continue to have friends in high places that vouched them and, you know, signed waivers for them and got them through. I mean, if you look at the entire career of Admiral Rickover, right? Now, clearly Tom Cruise's character is not Admiral Rickover, but I mean, this is a guy that should have been out of the Navy years and years before and should never have gotten to the rank of 4-star, but did. On the strength of his relationships and the strength of, you know, what he was bringing to the Navy. And, you know, I think that's, I thought it was a believable storyline. I thought that the, you know, obviously there was all these comments about how, oh, the mission at the end was so unbelievable and just wouldn't. And yes, would a mission like that go down today? Is it baffling that they decided that to expend all their Tomahawks on the airfield and not go after missile defense? I mean, that's certainly not how we would have planned the mission when I was in, right? I think we would have gone for air defense first and then the airfield to try and suppress any sort of fighter support. But it is what it is. It's Top Gun universe. You're just going to have to accept it. And the flying scenes were just amazing. I actually know one of the pilots who flew those scenes for Top Gun and were... the front seat for the pilots who were pretending to be in the front seat in the movie.
What you mean, the actors? Was that for the actors then? He was flying the aircraft while they were...
Yeah, so they were flying them around. And I remember he gave me a call after he got off the flight line. He's like, man, this is going to be a cool movie. The flying is absolutely nuts.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that... I'll be honest, the first Top Gun, I was sort of dragged along to see it, and I liked it in the air. But I thought it stank on the ground. I hated it on the ground. It was just too much, too cheesy and everything else. It just wasn't for me. And I think this one is better in the air and on the ground. And it kind of veers a little bit close to the edge of cheesiness. But I think it does deliver on straight ahead thrills and excitement. What else did I think about it? I thought it was totally crazy that they could... should issue a spoiler alert here, I suppose. But it's totally crazy that the two of the characters could happen to find... a Tomcat and then happened to just fire it up and fly. I mean, it was great. It was wonderful. But, you know, it just made me think, you know, this is they're going for broke here. And they did it with great, great style. And of course, that Tomcat thing raised the question of who were the F-18s attacking in Top Gun Maverick.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, who was it?
It was kind of like Russia-Iran, right?
Yeah.
It was like, it was like, we're worried about them getting nuclear power. They've got Tomcats.
Yeah.
That's Iran.
Yeah, exactly.
But yet they also had fifth-gen fighters, which that's Russia. There aren't too many rogue states out there under the level of sanctions that Iran is that, you know, can build, you know, fifth-gen fighters.
Yeah.
You know, that was actually one of the things where I wondered about, and I think potentially just because it was so close, they were so close to each other, was when they were in the Tomcat and those two fighters came after them. I mean, how far away was that from the carrier strike group? I mean, they had let's get to the things that I thought were cool about it, right? Even if the mission itself was a little bit unrealistic, first of all, just enjoy the movie. But second of all, there were elements of it that I really enjoyed. And that was this whole idea of you got to kind of see it work, right? You got to see the entire Navy working together, minus submarines, but that's not to say they weren't there. You got to see the E-2Ds up, right? So the E-2D
yeah,
is
that was
up.
Good.
That's
yeah,
the, yeah, and the, and it's providing providing the air picture, providing data links, doing what they do, and that was really cool. It's cool to see that Hollywood decided to include battle networks in the storyline, which E-2Ds are the sort of the crucial enablers of, and then obviously the strike at the beginning to try and suppress the airfield. It is a shame that they left that one hangar and just so happened to have the Tomcat.
Yeah, amazing.
In it, and they didn't.
Yeah,
they missed that one. Tomahawks are pretty good. I mean, they do miss from time to time, but feels like the whoever planned that mission maybe got it wrong, or maybe they got it right just in time for the movie. But yeah, no, I thought it was cool. I enjoyed it. Yeah, it was a cheesy ending, but you didn't get to see Tom Cruise flying a Tomcat. You know, what was the point of Top Gun?
Absolutely, absolutely. And one of the things that I found fun, being a movie reviewer, actually, before I did Defence or anything like that, when I was a teenager, my first paid writing was writing movie reviews back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And one of the great movies of that time, early 80s, was The Right Stuff, about mm-hmm. the Mercury 7 astronauts. So a lot of those guys were Navy aviators, and most memorably of all was Chuck Yeager, a legendary yeah. World War II fighter pilot who has this amazing scene where he takes up a starfighter and reaches for space and then has to eject and catches fire, his helmet catches fire. And then there's that really cool bit where he's walking out the desert and he's got his helmet under his arm and his parachute, and he's all burned, his parachute over his shoulder, his helmet under his arm, and a burned face. And it made me smile quite a bit when I saw that Tom Cruise riffed on that in this yes. movie. And I admired that, actually. I thought that's cool. And then there's been all this talk about the attack being like Star Wars and all that stuff. But actually, I thought that what they were doing was they were actually riffing on the Dam Busters and also 633 Squadron. I don't know if you've seen that
yes.
movie. You've seen 633 Squadron? Yeah. Well, when you see that as an adult, those aircraft on wires are just terrible that you see, mm-hmm. the models they use. But, you know, the attack, I thought, was very similar in some ways to get an inaccessible target was very good. So I thought there was quite a homage across Top Gun Maverick to quite a few movies. And I thought that was really good.
Yeah, I thought, yeah, I mean, I think I picked up a few sort of head nods throughout the way that you certainly, and they certainly referenced themselves quite a bit, which
yes.
of course you would expect. I really did like I know this is the cheesiest part of the Top Gun first one. It was when they're playing volleyball on the beach, right? In their jeans. But then they riffed on that in the next movie, or in Maverick, with the sort of two-way football where they're playing American football, when they're playing offense and defense at the same time, which you know, honestly, if you were like the volleyball scene in the first one had no value whatsoever. It was just eye candy, I think, to try and get women audiences into the movie theaters.
Probably,
in the 1980s,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But in this case, what he sort of pushed the story forward, it was they were having a legitimate training moment. They were showing how chaotic and silly and fun it is to play offense and defense at the same time. But obviously that's exactly what fighter pilots have to do if they're going on that kind of a bombing run in denied airspace, right? So they're going to have to play offense and defense at the same time. And I think there was the training value element of that, I thought, was actually quite good and believable.
So it's really a training film then. It's just a naval training film, yeah.
Ultimately, it is a story. Well, you know, this is what I liked about the first film. I always liked Iceman, right? And then Iceman has issues, right? He's not a perfect guy. He didn't take responsibility for the flame out that kills Goose. But I love that scene in the locker room where he confronts Maverick for being dangerous, and Maverick says, "Yes,
this is Top Gun 1, obviously."
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, and he says something. He's like, "Yeah, no, I am dangerous," and he's like, "Well, you're going to get everyone killed, and you need to decide whose side you're on." And that actually struck me as about as Navy a lesson as you can get, right? Like, maybe you don't like people around you, maybe you don't like your shipmate, maybe you don't like the people that you're training with, but ultimately you have to decide, like, are you going to make this mission successful? Are you on the right side, or are you here to, you know, make some point for yourself? Because ultimately this is a team sport. And I think that was what the first movie did very successfully. And it was certainly the lesson that Maverick learned. And if you carry that along to Top Gun, Maverick, I think there is that element of it. Yeah, he's still an outcast. He's still a rogue and somebody who just kind of exists at the largesse of a charitable senior officer who likes him. But ultimately, I think that was kind of it certainly dialed back significantly this like machismo personal, like there's certainly the character, the Hangman has that sort of machismo personal accomplishment aspect to it. But Maverick tamps down on it at every moment. Like even when he selects the pilots for the mission at the end, right? He's like, this is a mission that I've selected people for very specific reasons. It's a very specific mission. I'm picking very specific people for this specific mission. This isn't personal. And while there is this competitive sense that you would expect from highly talented mid-20s people, you did get the sense that this was a guy that had evolved from the first movie to understand that it's a team sport, and that getting home alive requires everyone pulling in the same direction.
Yeah, I think you're right. The evolution of Maverick was there to see, and that was good. Yeah, that meant that I could warm to him more in this movie than I did in the first one. And when it comes to evolution, it was at least good to see a good ending for Maverick in it, unlike Britain's naval hero, Commander James Bond. So, I mean, he evolved over... May he rest in peace. Yeah, there's no spoiler here. We all know about this. He evolved, you know, Daniel Craig evolved from Casino Royale in 2006 across... what was it, 5 movies, and he went off. James Bond in the movies is always going rogue, and I would like to see him just do a mission for, you know, Her Majesty for once, rather than go rogue all the time. But he evolved as well, and at the beginning of the Daniel Craig era, they put out a bio for him, which I did a feature on in the mag, where he was, you know, had been a submariner, was a naval officer, mm-hmm. and then got into some kind of special warfare thing with the Navy, etc. But then right at the end, that kind of came full circle with the most recent movie.
I thought it was a beautiful ending.
Well, yeah. I mean, it was, I suppose, a beautiful ending. But I, at the end of the day, I felt a little bit dissatisfied to see him killed by his own Navy. So I thought that was...
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if you think about it, to me... Right. It was this moment of because he looks up and he smiles. Right. And he's looking at the missiles coming in. He knows he's accomplished his mission. And yeah, if you're going to go out, you may as well, you may as well have control of it. And I don't know. So it wasn't that I could certainly understand the sense of disappointment that the own Navy had to kill him. And I don't think that would necessarily, this was an area that I have questions about in Top Gun Maverick, actually, where it's clear that Maverick's been shot down, and I saw that the helicopter takes off right from the deck of, I think, Abraham Lincoln, and certainly that's what you do when you're going on a SAR mission, but I was unclear if they were then going to then look for them, because then they have to steal a Tomcat to get back to the carrier. Like, no, stay put. We know where you are. We'll send a mission. Now, obviously, it just didn't strike me as it struck me as unrealistic that they wouldn't want to provide air cover at that point for like a rescue mission, because everything I've been trained on is you got a pilot down, you're going to go get him, and fast, because you don't have very much time. And it took sort of, I guess, Goose's son, to kind of go against orders to then go back and try to give him some cover, and then ultimately they tag up. And anyway, all the point is that I was a little concerned that they were kind of implying that they weren't going to send a SAR mission to go get her down pilot, but I don't think that's what happened. They did take that off the helicopter, but it was a concerning moment.
Well, of course, that's something that you or maybe I or anybody that served in the Navy or the military or whatever would see, wouldn't we? Get worried about it and start getting anxious about it that they didn't do it, or is it a detail that they should have followed through on, but it doesn't really matter. to most people. No. It's just.
But I will say that I was, when it comes to James Bond, I did think that the sort of the things that I liked about Daniel Craig's Bond, not to get too off topic, is that that sense of that fundamental service to country is his grounding, right? And when he's even and when, you know, in previous iterations of Bond, and certainly with the Goofy era of Bond, like the womanizing and the drinking is portrayed in this glamorous light.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, this is the glamorous side of John. Honest to goodness, the Daniel Craig Bond does not do that. Like, it's sometimes it's funny, but I think more often than not, it reads kind of sad and pathetic. It kind of the broken side of him is the one that womanizes and drinks too much. And when he's kind of at his lowest points, right, when he gets shot and he goes off into South America or the Caribbean or wherever he likes to go. And that's when he's drunk and he's womanizing. But that sort of core sense of crown and country, right, is what brings him back to doing his job over and over again. And I think where it relates to that ending, that's kind of what I liked about it, is that ultimately that sort of self-sacrifice good, and having that hand at the hand of your own beloved parent service. I mean, if you're going to have to die, I think I'd rather die that way than by some horrifying blood disease.
Yeah, that's true. And I suppose the good thing is that when he looked up...
Nanobots.
Yeah, exactly, those nanobots. But when he looked up and saw the missiles coming in, I suppose we do have to be grateful that he didn't do what Roger Moore would have done, which is to raise an eyebrow and just smiled. Sorry, I had to put that in, because that image implanted itself in my mind when you were saying how he looked up and smiled. I'll say, yeah, Roger Moore would have... you know, done the famous eyebrow as those missiles came in.
Exactly. Yeah.
Anyway, that's been a good chat there, David. Very good chat. Yeah. And I've enjoyed it. And thanks very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. It's been great chatting with you and catching up on all things naval and on the Ukraine conflict and certainly Top Gun. So thank you again for having me on.
Thank you for listening. And be sure to check out the July 2022 edition of the magazine, because in that we have a sparkling array of features, commentaries and analysis, including commentaries on the Falklands War 40 years on, lessons for today, and also lifting the Black Sea blockade, which is a very hot topic, and my own review of Top Gun. And among the other items are a look at the US Navy's bid to quick sink Chinese ships in time of war, the UK government lacking urgency in tackling certain naval capability gaps. Also in there is a look at how the Chinese military may be establishing a new base in the Solomon Islands, a consideration of the evolution of destroyers and cruisers post-World War II, plus coverage of Her Majesty the Queen and the Navy, the special relationship between the British sovereign and the senior service over the decades of her reign. And also the first firing of a SM-2 missile by a Danish frigate. It's all action-packed. If you'd like to obtain the magazine itself, please visit your local newsagent and pick one up from the shelf. Or, if you like, ask them if they can order it in. Alternatively, visit the Warships IFR website, warshipsifr.com, and you can obtain it that way. You can subscribe to get a hard copy each month direct to you wherever you are in the world, or get a digital edition. For more Warships IFR, you can visit our website at warshipsifr.com, follow us on Facebook at warshipsifr, and also Twitter at warshipsifr. And we also have a YouTube channel called Warships IFR TV. Thank you for listening, and there will be another episode of the Warships Pod unleashed soon.